Hi, and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Got up to various things. If you've been listening, you'd have heard some of them. If this is your first time, welcome, and if not, welcome back. So, yeah, episode 71. So we're getting on there now. It's a good few. Thank you for the downloads. Perhaps it gets boring me keep saying it, but I genuinely appreciate it. Unbelievable response, really, of how the downloads have gone. We're over 19,000 downloads now in total, which I find mind-boggling. And I think 18,500 was my mum, but, you know, that doesn't matter, does it? At the end of the day, it's out there getting downloaded, so thank you for that. And not really big news, probably old news now, but we finally got a Facebook page after over a year. I kept intending to do it. I'd done all the other things, all the Instagrams and YouTubes and TikToks and all that. And every week I just put out, you know, just a reminder that a new episode has come out. And I think I get a certain amount of downloads from that. But I suddenly remember that I'd never actually done a Facebook page for Police Stories Podcast. So if you put that into Facebook, you'll find us, and perhaps you can give us a like on that. It wouldn't hurt. That's gone out to a few people this week, so that's good. And again, some more coffee's bought for me. Thank you very much. Right, that's the initial intro stuff out of the way. So we're going to get on, and this week we're going to talk about probably one of the last jobs that I ever dealt with in the Met before I moved on, which is where we're heading, and almost certainly one of the most bizarre jobs that I've ever done in the police. And see what you think about this one. This is a little strange, and particularly just everything about it was bizarre. Not just the incident itself, but who perhaps rang up about it, who was at the scene, as you're here. So it's a bit of a strange one. So we were on the dive team, and we had nothing on that day, I don't think, which is very unusual. I think we had maybe a training dive planned, and the reason for that was we had a couple of people with us that were thinking about joining the Marine unit, I think, as opposed to just the dive teams. If you remember, the Marine unit was slightly separate from the dive team. You had to be on the Marine unit first, generally, before you were then able to get onto the dive team. We had a couple of people, I think it was a male and female cop, who were interested in the Marine unit, and they were having a day out generally around the unit to have a look at what we did, you know, and decide if that was something they wanted to apply for. And they were given the opportunity, well, we're doing a training dive today. Do you want to come along and just see what happens, you know, and have a chat, and we can see what it's all about. Now, normally we were in our big sort of HGV, our dive truck. But on this day, we had a smaller Sprinter van, because I think our truck was in for service. So we had just a small sort of police minibus, like you see a lot of the sort of riot teams driving around in, and that was our intention for diving out of that day. But we received a call in the morning. In fact, we hadn't long started, that there was some sort of an incident occurring at a swimming pool in London. Now, you might laugh, and we did initially, like, a swimming pool, you know, haven't they got lifeguards, you know, what do they need a dive team for? But it became apparent as we were going there, we were asked to travel there on Blues. So we sort of made best progress, and it was a long way from our base. So it took a good sort of half an hour, 45 minutes on Blues to get there. And it goes something like this. So what happened was, a phone call came in about a male acting strange in the swimming pool. And when I say strange, he was a very large, muscular guy. And it was, you know, in the morning, I think it was like 10 or 11 in the morning. A busy swimming pool with, you know, mixed groups, kids doing their swimming lessons, and you know, all the sort of you know, mums with their babies and all the things that you'd expect to be happening at a swimming pool. And I think this was like a leisure centre, so it had a gym attached to it as well. And this very large sort of muscular guy, you know, I'm not quite sure what was happening with him, but he for certain was having some sort of a mental breakdown or something, you know, mentally going on. Because he stripped off at the edge of the pool, and then he defecated in the pool, some of which got on him, so he ended up kind of covered in it, naked in the pool, and then basically just started creating a disturbance within the pool, shouting and screaming. He was ripping things off the wall. So on the wall you have the various sort of life-saving equipment, things like there was a defib in there, I think, you know, and a first aid kit and various, you know, signs saying do this and don't do that. And also the great big long kind of metal pole that they use to hook people out, you know, the swimming pool that are in trouble. He'd just basically gone crazy and started ripping this stuff off the wall. He'd thrown a load of things on the floor, which had smashed. And I think one of them had like a glass lid, or certainly a Perspex lid, because he'd managed to get himself a really long, sharp sort of shard of, I'm not sure it was glass or plastic, but it was shaped basically like a dagger. And it ended up being about sort of 8 or 10 inches long, which he was holding in his hand so tightly that he cut his hand. So he was now bleeding, and also had cut his feet by walking through, you know, the glass, the things he'd smashed. So of course, the pool was evacuated, and basically the staff effectively locked this guy in this room. Now, they'd managed to secure, fairly early on, local cops had got there, and initially they just wanted to contain this guy till they knew what he was about. So they'd posted uniformed cops, response cops, with round shields, short shields they're called, sort of riot shields, on the fire exit, so he couldn't escape that way, because they were trying to contain him and keep him in this pool area. But you had this scenario where he was wandering around in there, shouting and screaming, big sharp piece of whatever it was in his hand, bleeding, you know, various sort of feces in and around the pool and on him. And he was taking it in turns to run along. So now, unfortunately, there was like a windowed viewing gallery, so that when you were around the edge of the pool, you know, if you weren't swimming, but, you know, your relatives were in there or whatever, you could watch them swim. And of course, when all the police were coming into the location, then he could see them coming in. So he was standing there sort of shouting and screaming and threatening the cops that were now coming in, that he could see sort of pouring into the reception area with his sharp piece of glass or whatever it was. And it was a little bit of an unknown, to say the least. Now, you might think that's quite a bizarre job to start with, but, you know, it's about to get a whole lot more bizarre, because the person who was at the pool, that I don't know if he'd actually called it in, but certainly he was involved and was speaking to the police about what was happening, because he'd been in the, I'm not sure if he'd been in the pool area or the gym area to start with, and again, I think the gym area looked down on the pool, was quite a well-known actor at the time. His name is Danny John Jules. And certainly in the UK, if you're of a certain age, about, I don't know, it must be 20 odd years ago now, there was a long running series called Red Dwarf, which was a comedy series based in space. It was a bit of a Mickey take of Star Trek, effectively. Again, if you sort of YouTube it or whatever, Red Dwarf, you'll see what I mean. And it was about these, you know, sort of various different characters that had been cast off into space and couldn't get back to Earth and all this. But it was a comedy. It was very funny. And very, very popular at the time. Well, this Danny John Jules played the cat in it. Now, you might think cat, you know, if you haven't seen it, you perhaps wouldn't understand. But basically, so the story goes that these guys had been, I think, like, you know, cryogenically frozen, or they'd been put into some sort of deep frozen sleep while their spacecraft was traveling through the universe. And, you know, when they actually woke up the other end, like, you know, 10,000 years had passed or something. And now, Danny John Jules was the ship's cat at you know, when they'd gone into the sleep mode. But by the time that they'd come out, he'd evolved into basically what was a human with sort of sharp, pointy teeth. His character was hilarious, or certainly I thought so, and thousands of other people did too. And it was quite a long-running series. It went on for several years. And, yeah, it was very popular in the UK and was very funny. But bizarrely, he'd now taken on a role in Strictly Come Dancing, I think it was, which I think there's a similar thing in America with a different name. You know, it's these people where you get a professional dancer who gets teamed up with, you know, a celebrity of some sorts, and they take them through, you know, ballroom dancing and things. Well, he'd either just signed up for it or was in training for it. So he was really hitting the gym and the swimming pool hard to get fit for Strictly Come Dancing. And he found himself at the pool when this all kicked off, you see. So we've now got this scenario, and we're on blues to this location still, trying to figure out, and we had all our dive kit with us because we were had this training dive planned anyway, and we were trying to figure out, you know, so hang on, let me get this straight. The cat from Red Dwarf is there. We've got a big naked guy running around covered in poo and blood with some sort of weapon threatening everyone, but he's in the pool area, you know. And initially, of course, as well as the local response officers, they'd also sent TSG, which is the territorial support group, the sort of riot teams, you know, that deal with violent people, you know, with their shields and tasers and what have you. So they'd gone as well, but this was a total unknown. Now, normally you have, both in firearms and public order, you have a TACAD, a tactical advisor, who will sit down with someone who's been sort of put in charge of running whatever the incident is, whether it's a big car accident, a fire, a riot, whatever. There'll be like a, you know, a command chain put in place, and generally there's a gold, silver and bronze put in place, and the bronze commander might be, you know, a sergeant on the ground. Silver could be an inspector or chief inspector sort of in the background somewhere, and then quite often the gold commander would be like a superintendent sat back at the base with this overview of what was happening, and then he would have a tactical advisor, or she, sat with them. And that would then help them decide, okay, well, you know, I'm looking at the public order manual and it says, you know, it's a violent man in the street and we do this and we do that. However, I suspect that TACAD was going through the public order manual looking for, you know, naked men covered in poo at a swimming pool, and probably was coming up short. So I suspect they were busy trying to figure out what they're called. Now, every time officers went into the sort of pool area with a view to try and arrest him or get hold of him, he was running off and jumping back in the pool, still with his weapon, still covered in unpleasantness. And so they were struggling a bit, really, to come up with the tactics. So some bright spark somewhere said, I know, we've got a dive team, call the dive team, you know, so hence our involvement, and we found ourselves en route to this job. So to say it was a bit of a strange one, say, and then you add in the cat from Red Dwarf into the mix as well. And again, if you Google that, his name, and, you know, like swimming pool police incident or whatever, I did this morning, and actually it brings it all up, and it shows some pictures and some video, and I think you'll see a picture of the guy in the water in the swimming pool online. Yeah, very bizarre job. So we turned up, and the first thing that happened was when we got there, and I don't forget, we had these two people that were looking to join the unit with us as well, who were, you know, normal cops, so they were fairly well used to strange things. But of course they were also saying, this is a very weird job, you know, do you do this sort of thing often? And of course we were joking with them, oh yeah, there's every other day really, we have, you know, a madman in a swimming pool covered in unpleasantness, you know, it's just how we roll, you know. Needless to say, we were like, no, we've never dealt with anything quite like this before. So we turned up at the scene and we walked into the reception, or certainly I walked into the reception and sort of round the corner where this glass viewing gallery was to get a view on this guy. And as soon as I sort of walked up near to the glass to have a look at him, trying to be subtle, he spotted me and came over and basically started doing some dance in front of me with his sharp piece of glass or whatever it was, waving it about and making various threats. So he couldn't get to me, but it was... it was a little strange, but it did give me a pretty good idea for him. And I was able to have a chat with the rest of the team and confirm, you know, this is a very large guy, you know. I'm not quite sure how this is going to work out. So we had a chat, you know, there's absolutely obviously no tactic as such in place to deal with him specifically. Obviously, tasers were very much thought of because they're a fantastic bit of kit and they stop you getting seriously injured as the cop normally. And quite often the actual person as well, because old school, before, you know, tasers and things, the only thing we had to deal with anyone that was violent was either basically our fists or, you know, truncheons. You know, I was issued a wooden truncheon when I joined. That's kind of all you had. And what happened is you had to get close and get hands on with people. And of course, if they were up for a fight, you were going to get, you know, you were going to get lumped, you know, you were getting hit. There was no doubt about it. And if this was someone who was a bit handy, then for sure, you know, you were probably going to get a kick in, and so were your colleagues. Of course, now you've got the, I say luxury, that's perhaps stretching it, but, you know, a taser has a 21 foot range. So you have the option of taking that step back and, you know, and being able to fire your taser with a little bit of a safety zone between you and them. And then, you know, the worst that happens generally is that they will fall on the floor and they might have a couple of bumps and bruises, but it saves the cops getting seriously injured and, you know, potentially them as well, because if you had to get in, you know, old school and be fairly aggressive with these people, then there was a very real chance they were getting injured as well. So tasers featured quite highly on the planning and the talking. But of course, the big issue where we were was the swimming pool and, you know, and the damp environment that a swimming pool is, because, of course, a taser is delivering 50,000 volts. So, you know, tasers and water don't really mix. But you've got to be ever so careful as well. And we knew this from the sort of boat background as well, of where you're standing if a taser is fired. I had a scenario once with a colleague in the previous force when I was down on the south coast, when I was on firearms, where we'd had basically a roll around with this guy who was meant to have a firearm on him in a flat. Now, I'll make it clear, I wasn't here. This is the story that I was told. I wasn't there at the time, but he, my colleague, found himself trying to restrain this guy along with other cops on the floor. And I say restrain, you know, it makes it sound a bit more official, but it was a bun fight, you know, it was a, basically a roll around on the floor, you know, sort of wrestling, trying to get hold of this guy and restrain him. And somebody managed to taser him, but in the process of fighting with this guy, he had wet himself, and I think he was very drunk. And my friend, my colleague, found himself kneeling in this puddle of piss, basically, when the guy was lit up with a taser. And because he was kneeling in the urine, when the taser was fired, he also got zapped through this guy's urine, and he got a decent shock as well, which certainly made him jump. So yes, I was all too aware of, you know, the dangers of it. You know, we didn't want to find ourselves ankle deep in water. And we talked about various things, you know, how are we going to deal with this guy? So we thought, well, we don't want to go in full on dive kit because it's very heavy and cumbersome. Can you imagine trying to fight with someone with a full face mask on cylinders? And of course, it's very easy for him just to rip your mask off. But if he jumps back in the water, we would have a huge advantage if we had, you know, like a wetsuit or a dry suit on and fins, because you immediately have a, you know, a sort of big mechanical advantage over someone who hasn't got fins on. And we knew this because we had a public order tactic for dealing with counter demonstrators in the water, where we did just that. We entered the water in dry suits with fins on and were able to, quite well practiced at restraining people in the water. So the thinking was we kind of cobble something together like this. But the big issue was that, you know, if he was in the deep end, for example, there was a very real risk that even with two, three or four of you in the water at any one time, if he was, you know, properly psychotic and being a big lump that he was, you know, he could have basically, you know, tried to drown us, hold us under. And that actually would have been very difficult to negate. And we couldn't have used any of our normal sort of skills or powers or, you know, tactics, if you like, to do it. And what was happening was, while we were having this conversation and talking it through and having to think about quite what we were going to do to deal with this guy, we'd gone round to the like the entrance to the male changing rooms, and at the entrance between the changing room and the pools there is a shower area. So the idea is that you kind of washed your feet and you showered off before you enter the pool. Well, that's where the TSG was set up with their long shields, so the sort of 6 foot high, you know, plastic riot shields. And they were set up with a half a dozen of them across there with shields. And every now and then the guy would come over and like kick and punch the shields and shout and scream and threaten them and then sort of back off again. And if any of them tried to sort of break ranks to get hold of him to carry out some sort of arrest, he was immediately turning and running back and jumping into the pool. So it was a bit of a game to him, you know, and but potentially a dangerous one with his weapon, that he, you know, his makeshift weapon that he had. So anyway, there was certainly a discussion, and we were, you know, thinking quite how we were going to deal with this. And we'd gone round to where the shields were, and at this point the TSG guys had deliberately taken about three or four steps back. It's sort of to the edge of the shower area, so that if he came forward again to sort of attack their shields, he would have been even further away from the pool, which they were thinking might give them an opportunity to be able to get in and you know, and cut him off. And in fact, that's sort of what happened in them, because just while we were getting kitted up and deciding how we were going to do it and quite how this was going to work, and I really don't know what it would have looked like, he approached the shields again, went to one end of the sort of six shields that were shoulder to shoulder and started kicking and punching one of the shields. Well, one of the guys on the other end of the sort of line of shields managed to lean his arm around the edge of the shields with his taser and fire a taser at the guy when he wasn't in the shower area. But it hit him before he saw it coming and before he got back to the pool itself. So we heard this almighty crash of shields, shouting and screaming and all sorts going on. And then when we went round to help, basically there was about half a dozen, you know, sort of TSG officers on top of him. This guy had been successfully tasered, which had brought him down. They disarmed him, you know, and he was handcuffed and was eventually led away for not only medical treatment because he had various cuts on him, but also ultimately he was sectioned, you know, under the Mental Health Act and was put into like a secure unit for a period of time while he was assessed. I don't know actually what happened to him after that, but it was, yeah, it was a little bit of a strange one. And just coming back to the point about the tasers and pre-tasers, another incident that I found myself involved in pre-tasers, to give you an idea, I was again down south on the south coast in my first force. I had about only about 3 or 4 years service, and I was on the TUCE unit. We talked about that way back if you listened to some of the early episodes, when I was sort of teaching, you know, new cops how to sort of how to become cops effectively, although at that time I was certainly feeling a bit out of my depth on how to do that. And we got called to a domestic. Now at the time, body armor wasn't issued to individuals. A car just had two sets of body armor in it, you know. It was one size fits all, so you had very small sort of female cops who had, you know, ridiculously large body armor that didn't fit them at all and was pretty much useless, and equally you had some very big guys that had, you know, sort of tiny armor that it equally didn't cover anything. But that's just how it was then, you know. We're talking 30 odd years ago now, and we had these two sets of body armor in the car. We'd been out doing another inquiry, and this domestic came in just around the corner from where we were, and I had a tutee that I was teaching. So I said to him, look, we're right close, we'll just nip around the corner and deal with that domestic. It sounded very low level, and it didn't sound like it was particularly kicking off. It was just, you know, neighbours had reported a sort of an argument, and it was very low level. But the problem is the sort of the big nasty jobs can come in like that, you know, something you don't expect, and you go wander in. And sure enough, on this occasion, I walked up to the front door. It was a basement flat, knocked on the door, and was met with this very, very angry guy who said, you know, what do you want? Although not quite like that. And when I, you know, before I got a chance to say sort of who we were, obviously we were in full uniform, so it's pretty obvious we didn't have body armor because it was back in the car. And this was the issue of not wearing it all the time, because you don't necessarily get a heads up that, oh, hang on, I should put body armor on for this job. You know, there's no suggestion of anything more than a minor verbal argument. And he basically slammed the door in my face. So I turned around to the tutee and was like, oh, a bit rude, isn't it? You know, so, but then continued with the arguing inside. We could hear the shouting. So in the end, I managed to force entry through the front door, and took one step into the corridor. And when I looked off to my left, the corridor was stretching out before me, quite long, about 20 or 30 feet long, with other rooms coming off it. And then at the end of that corridor, there was clearly a kitchen area, and I could see like a cooker and washing machine and what have you. And he briefly went out of view and then returned to my sight with a very large carving knife, about a 12-inch carving knife, basically in his hand, and said, you know, you want to be a hero, come in and, you know, we'll sort this out, kind of thing. But he was absolutely raving at that point, you know. He was really, really angry. So it didn't take a lot for me to figure out, you know, no body armor, just the two of us, one of whom is a guy who, you know, best will in the world, had about, I don't know, 6 weeks in the police. No one else here. I'd be pretty stupid to go in and take this guy on. And this is what I was saying about, you know, pre-taser, we didn't have any sort of gas at that point, no pepper spray, no CS. It was just literally basically fists and a tiny wooden truncheon, which a lot of us didn't even bother carrying because it was fairly useless. So it didn't take a lot for me to back out, close the door and stay by the front door. And then I sent the tutee around to the back door so we could keep a very loose containment on that address while we called up, or I called up and said, you know, I've been threatened with a knife, need more units. And because of that call, you know, people take that seriously because it's not the sort of call that comes every day. So I had a lot of cops there very quickly, and I was lucky that the town I was working in was relatively big. So very quickly we had probably six police cars, maybe a dozen cops turned up, and then nearby was also a police dog handler. They came down as well. So we put on a much better containment, you know, had a decent amount of people, resources, sort of front and back. And then it became a bit of a siege, really, a bit of a waiting game, because, you know, that's how it is. You're not going to go in and force the option if you don't need to. Now, if he'd have been, you know, attacking the female that was in the property still with him, that had been different, we'd have had to go in regardless, because you don't get the luxury of sitting off and going, well, I'm not sure it's safe, you know, because the bottom line is sometimes you have to do stuff that isn't safe. So we sat off, and then I think a negotiator was called. But I'm pretty confident before a negotiator got there, like a formal negotiator, one of the senior cops had stepped up and had made sort of verbal contact with this guy, and had then, you know, sort of talked him through, look, you know, there's loads of us out here. This isn't going to end well for you. At the moment, this isn't too serious. You know, we can square this away. You just need to put the knife down. You need to come out and we'll have a chat. Of course, you're going to be arrested. But no one needs to get hurt here. And it was actually quite, you know, a sensible conversation. The guy had calmed down by now. I was told to keep well out of the way because the bloke had made reference to me several times that he really didn't like me. And again, that is working with your strengths and weaknesses. In that, if there's someone, you know, one of your team that, you know, a bad guy or girl takes a particular dislike to, don't push it, don't leave them there and continue to wind the situation up. Get that person just to take a step back, you know, and then let somebody else try. And it might be that's all it needs to sort of diffuse that situation. So it's all about communication and learning to use, you know, the right people and the right skills. So that's what happened. Basically, I sort of took a step back and was on the periphery so he couldn't see me. And then eventually they talked him out and he came out, and there was no issues, there was no injuries. But nowadays, you know, with the taser, would I have gone in with a taser? Possibly. The difference is, even if I decided to take the same course of action, which was definitely the safest, had he now followed me, you know, because I went out, closed the door and waited by the door. Thankfully, he didn't then follow me, come to the door, open the door and start trying to stab me, you know, which was obviously an option. Had he done that with a taser, I'd have had a decent chance of properly, you know, defending myself. And maybe with that, you know, that bit of distance, which just buys you some safety. I'm a great advocate of the taser. You know, it's a fantastic defense tool for sure. But but it's different times, you know, and that's how it is. So that's pretty much it for today. So we've dealt with two incidents there. Obviously, we went off on a bit of a tangent. A couple of sieges, if you like. First one, very unusual in its type. Second one, you know, perhaps slightly more conventional in how we used to have to deal with things a bit differently. And like I said, that first incident was pretty much the last incident I ever dealt with in the Met, because I think I've talked about in two or three episodes ago that somewhere around about now-ish, in fact, you know, if we're now looking back, it was kind of year and a half previous, I'd moved to Scotland. I was still working in London. I was working in the Met and flying down each week. And my intention was I would probably retire early. And I had to do that. I worked out for about 3 years and then I'd be able to retire. But the reality is I did the commuting back and forward for about a year and a half flying back. And it just wasn't practical, you know, just the planes kept being late, the trains were delayed and cancelled. It just turned into a nightmare, and you know, I was constantly tired. I was forever getting ill and it just wasn't working out. So it was around about this time that, as I'd transferred before from my first force to the Met, somebody suggested, well, why don't you look at transferring to Scotland? You know, and I was thinking, well, you know, I don't know if it's going to be that easy. So I found myself on the Police Scotland website, just looking through at the transferee pages for, you know, sort of already sort of qualified experienced cops that want to transfer to various forces. And this happens all the time between forces all around the country, to find that they were particularly looking for people, not only transferees, but in a particular area. And they gave like a code for that area, the division, which I didn't understand not being in Police Scotland at the time. But I went away and researched it to look at the area they were talking about to find that it was actually where I was already living. So that was great news. So I thought, well, you know, that would solve a few problems. The slight issue was I was still enjoying the diving and very much enjoying being on the dive team. But, you know, I was aware that kind of my health probably wasn't going to last for the next year and a half, you know, before I could retire. And I thought, well, you know, I've been on the dive team kind of 8 years now, been on the Marine unit 10 years at that point. So sometimes, you know, a change is as good as a rest, as they say. So I thought, let's go for it. So that's what I did. I applied to transfer. And on the next episode, I'll talk to you how that worked out. And then, we'll go through some of the differences. We'll talk about perhaps the transferee process, what that looks like. And then some of the big differences between the forces. And there are quite a few, because actually there's quite a difference in some of the laws as well between England and Scotland. There's some very different legislation which you have to learn, which we'll talk about next time. But hope you found it interesting. Thanks very much for listening. Hopefully you got all the way through to the end. Appreciate it. Perhaps you come back and listen to some more. Have a good week. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.